Welcome back to the Crypto Policy and Ethics Track. As a reminder, make sure to use the microphones. We have lunch right after the session at 12:40 in the Hemingway Ballroom. This morning, we have Bart Preneel. He'll be talking to us about revisiting threat models for cryptography. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to see so many of you here. So who was here for the talk of Matt Green this morning? Okay, this is a part I will skip, but not everybody has seen it. So what I want to talk about is how cryptography has been attacked. And of course, we have seen some recent leaks in which we see how cryptography was attacked. And so the point we want to make is that, of course, cryptography is probably the most robust and secure part of our security systems, but we probably have not been thinking enough how it gets actually broken. And of course, we will find out how nation states do it, and we can learn from this, not only the crypto, but also the end systems. We will look at how crypto is deployed and maybe what we should do ahead. More than 20 years ago, I attended a talk by Bob Morris, who was at that time head of the crypto department of the NSA, and he taught us something very important, which I will never forget for the rest of my life. Will the run of cryptanalysis look for plain text? Right? In fact, most stuff is still not encrypted. And of course, we know that some government agencies have access to upstream, which means they intercept communications, but also with the PRISM program to information stored in servers. From the same revelations, Snowden documents, we learned after a couple of months that actually there is the Bull Run program and that how the NSA goes after encryption with a whole range of techniques, and including supercomputers, so there is computation involved, trickery, and behind-the-scenes persuasion. So what I'll try to do in the next slides is to summarize this in a more structured way, because I guess even if you read those documents, or maybe you're not allowed to read them, it's kind of a whole bunch of unstructured things, so I try to structure it a bit. So first thing is assume people do use encryption, because so there is actually no plain text, so there is encryption. Something you can do is, of course, ask for the key. This is very convenient because if people actually use encryption and you get the key, then you can also decrypt. So we learned something, which is called the existence of national security letters. Of course, we knew about these things before because they existed since the 80s. And they usually come with gag orders, which means that those who receive them can't speak about them. And so the estimate is that about 300,000 were received since 2001. So, of course, because the Snowden documents deal with NSA and GCHQ, I will be speaking mostly about those things, but I think it's also important for you to reflect that other governments may have similar mechanisms. So you don't only look at how the US government is compromising maybe some foreign systems or maybe some US systems used abroad, but maybe you should also think about foreign governments and they will use the same things. If they were not using those techniques before Snowden, they will probably be doing it now because they also read those slides and they study what's happening there. So I guess this is why it's useful to find out. It's hard to get to concrete cases. There was, of course, the LavaBit case discussed by the previous speaker. It was an email provider. There was the Yahoo case. Yahoo actually fought the letter. And there was a handful of cases where the letters were fought and the gag orders were fought. And there were some other things where we have much less facts, but you can just speculate. Okay, and examples are the Silent Circle email service, which was shut down overnight as well. So, of course, once you actually are aware of this, you should maybe think about forward secrecy. I guess forward secrecy is a concept you may be familiar with, was introduced by Diffie, Wiener, and Van Oorschot in 1992, and which more or less says that if your key is compromised today, does it actually mean something for your past communications? So government agencies may have the decision that they store all encrypted communications in some server, say in Utah, and then once they get a key, they may actually decide to go back to everything they stored there as ciphertext and try to decrypt this. So if you want to actually prevent this, you should use Diffie-Hellman-like systems with forward secrecy. So, and in Diffie-Hellman, your long-term private key is only used for signing, so if those are revealed later, you actually don't compromise past communications. So, there is, of course, other ways you may obtain those keys as security letters. For example, the downgrade attack or the logjam attack, where it was shown that actually remnants of the old export control policies of 512-bit keys affecting many of us in the 90s, and even if those policies were abolished, it turns out that a lot of products still supported those old versions, and The great research from Matt Green and others showed that actually can be used, these old options in the software can be used to actually downgrade during negotiation and then break it in real time and then actually read the communications. So, and of course, it may also apply to IP servers. And unfortunately, there is still quite some servers that support 512-bit keys and are vulnerable to these attacks. You would not be surprised to know that, of course, GCHQ has a database looking at all TLS servers and keys and what is being supported there, and they're probably not the only ones. So if you can't get the private key, why not substitute the public key? Because if you can replace the public key by your public key, then you may actually know the corresponding private key. So that's the third trick in the basket. And so, of course, we have about 12 million TLS SSL servers. This is before Let's Encrypt came online, that actually use encryption. And of course, we know that there is many ways in which governments have been circumventing this. And the biggest problem, of course, is the 660 CAs, which are in the browsers. The same problem happens in the mobile phone, where there is similar stores, either on a phone base or maybe on a per app base. And of course, there is a very big governance issue with those public keys, with those root keys in browsers or in mobile ecosystems. We also know that after Snowden, there have been some initiatives to improve this. For example, Google has put forward the certificate transparency solution where it would be clear which certificates you have been issuing. And because of those technologies and other things like pinning, many players have been exposed. Like in the Symantec case, it was test certificates that were flying out in the wild, but several governments have been actually exposed issuing certificates for Google where they were not supposed to do this. So we use a lot of cryptography to protect session keys and Diffie-Hellman and whatever, all kind of cool crypto, but at the top layer, if you have a bad governance of your public keys in the browser, well, then you can, of course, compromise everything. And I guess the most spectacular attack was, of course, the cryptanalysis of MD5 with a new technique to create a flame malware to actually get attack MD5 and create fake certificates using cryptanalysis. So there was quite some papers about this. And there is also good news. There is a grassroots movement, Let's Encrypt, that actually started issuing certificates. And I guess it's more like a community trust effort rather than a commercial effort. They've been live since November 2015, and you can look at their graphs. So they actually have, at this moment, as you can see, about 40 million fully qualified domains active, so compared to the 10 or 12 million issued by the commercial CA. So I guess this is a positive consequence of Snowden. So Matt Green talked a lot about backdoors in cryptographic systems, and he explained in full detail the dual EC problem together with exploitation in Juniper routers. One thing he didn't give, but some extra piece of information I want to give you, is that Moti Jung and Adam Young, actually most of his research was done in the late 90s and early 2000s, but actually 2004 they wrote a book called Crypto Virology, which you can order on Amazon, and it's a recommended reading if you want to understand more about this. So the summary of Matt Green's talk, but of course only in two slides, is that if you put a trapdoor in pseudonym number generator, then, of course, you are in business, because that means that what you do in this thing is you have a seed, which depends on information which is hard to predict, like the clock or free memory, and you produce cryptographic keying material, but also nonces for the protocols. And those nonces are typically public, and the idea of having a trapdoor in this thing is that from the nonce, you can actually find the internal operations of the key material in the PRNG and then predict future session keys. And so it turns out that this was actually found in the wild in the dual EC generator standardized by NIST among three others. In spite of many warnings and critical comments of academic community, this standard was accepted and adopted by major players. And then, of course, there was a very big incident discovered when in Juniper Screen OS, it was discovered that this generator was there, but with a different backdoor. And so probably some other nation or some other player actually put their backdoor in to actually take over. So something cryptographers have always been warned about. Maybe one comment I want to make as addition to what Matt Green said about this. Okay, I recommend that you look at his slides if you haven't seen the talk. Part of the mechanism was through certification, because in fact, if you read the dual EC standard, it says you have to use the specific P and Q to get FIP certification. And you were even warned against using different P and Q, because you were warned that there could be security problems if you use different P and Q, which I guess a warning which Juniper didn't pay attention too much to. Now, I was actually at the honor to serve on the committee doing a review of NIST processes when these things were leaked. This is 2 years ago. And so something I tried to investigate is what happens if you decided to implement a different PNQ? Could you still get your product certified? And the answer was, we actually don't know, because nobody ever tried. But if you wanted to get certification, you definitely had to implement the specific PNQ prescribed by the standard. But if you would add different ones, you probably would have hit an unknown situation and probably delayed your product by several months because nobody knew how to certify your product. So that's something else I found out during the investigation. So the bottom line is that, so what Matt Green showed you is the use of backdoors, but so there is also other mechanisms, as I said, asking for keys or passing public keys or maybe doing downgrade attacks or having the backdoors. So what we know in state of the art is that at least 2001, using some of those mechanisms, the NSA was able to encrypt 20,000 secure VPN connections. And there is some interesting details in the graph where you have this long-haul system, and we still don't know exactly what is happening there. But I guess the question should be, which other nations have developed or are developing similar technology and using similar tricks? So something else we've actually learned from the Snowden documents is that, well, maybe you want to undermine the cryptography in many ways, but what about undermining the end systems? Because in the end, if you communicate information, you want the recipient to receive it. So most of us can't read ciphertext and decrypt in our brains. So in fact, what's in the computer is plain text. So if you undermine the computer systems, you actually get the plain text. And I guess most of you have seen this picture, so I don't have to comment on this. But so there are techniques where extra features or chips are being added. In this case, the example is from Cisco routers, but I'm sure there will be other vendors who benefit from those additions. As a consequence of these revelations, I have some companies I work with who now pick up all their devices in person. It's not very green. It's not very efficient, but I guess if you don't want to get boxes with extra features, then you have to pick up the boxes from the vendor yourself. So in Christmas 2014, Der Spiegel leaked a lot of documents on the tailored access operations program. So this is mostly tuned towards going after those people who don't connect to the internet and are really paranoid. And again, probably some of you are the same thing, and some of you may have similar opponents. I think if you're a hacker or a hardware freak, this is fantastic. These leaks, I mean, it's like the dream of every hacker. If you can find out what kind of cool things are in there in this catalog, there is hundreds and hundreds of devices that allow you to bridge air gaps. Okay, so I guess the good thing of those things is they can be used for mass surveillance because they require specific devices being produced and added. So there is, I would say, as a government or a society, you can have some control by limiting the budget of your surveillance agencies. They can only produce a limited number of those things and go only after the real targets. So they define the cool chips that are being implanted. I mean, the one which I always find very interesting is this Rage Master. So what they do is they implant a chip between your motherboard and your screen, okay? But then they remotely power this from 20 kilometers away with radar. This is how this chip is being powered. And then it emits radiation, okay? And this radiation is picked up, I guess, again, with a powerful antenna at some distance. So without ever having to come closer than 20 kilometers, they can see what's on your screen. I think that's really cool. I don't know whether it's healthy that people shine with radar beams at your laptop. But of course, if you're a day later hit with a Hellfire missile, that's also not healthy. So I guess maybe that's something that people don't worry too much about it. So of course, the other thing was discussed already by the previous speaker from ACLU. So it's not only about collecting information, about knowing information, but also exploits. And there is a very big problem of exploits of the end systems. So I first showed you hardware exploits, but there is, of course, also software exploits, which have the advantage that they can be installed remotely and at a very large scale. Of course, since if you read the press, you see that's not only this seems to be every developer agency has to do this, and I guess there is also many other nations who are now doing this. What about countries which are too small to do this, actually? I mean, like my country, Belgium, we don't have a budget for several hundred people searching for 0 days and writing exploits. But then there is companies like Hacking Team, and they actually provide these exploits as a service to you. You can buy those exploits, or you can have this service, and their motto is that they want to make the life of the police easy. Okay? So how do we know about Hacking Team? Well, Hacking Team was hacked, and so some of their tools and some of their customers were revealed. I think I recommend you go look at these things. It's really very interesting. In this case, it's not the US government, so probably even if you have a clearance, you're free to look at all this stuff. So I think it's really the debate which was already raised by the previous speaker in what to do with 0 days. So I think we probably all agree that if you look at us as a community of people who try to make the internet secure, we have a pretty hard task. It's pretty difficult for the low cost, the low effort people want to spend on security in terms of budget. It's quite hard to roll out an infrastructure in which society depends more and more to make it secure. It turns out that our governments are actually hoarding 0 days, and then they try to decide whether or not they will refill them. And so I guess the good news is that what we hear from the NSA is that that they made a claim last year that more than 90% of their 0 days are revealed to the vendors. Of course, what they did not say is what happened to the 5% they don't reveal. It was also not said in this statement when they reveal it. Maybe they first use it 15 years for exploitation and then they reveal it. So I guess it's a major problem. And of course, I don't have to say too much about this, but it's great to have good cryptography, but if your end system is exploited, it really doesn't matter. Okay, and I guess I'm not going to go too much into the detail, but of course we saw the APTs like Aurora, Stuxnet, Region, and so on. We have the mechanisms of quantum insertion and the Fox Acid program, and then if you look at just what the shadow brokers reveal, all these kind of tools are available, and of course they're used for good purposes, but as cyber weapons, they can leak out, they can also be used against you. I think that's something we have to keep in mind when we make decisions about this. It's, of course, great to have cyber weapons and to be able to undermine your opponent, but, of course, you also are vulnerable to them and they can be turned against you. Plus, of course, while there is many great minds in the U.S., unfortunately, there is also other nations that have great minds and that may do the same thing. And so this is the threat environment you have been looking at or you will be looking at in the next decade. Sum it all up, how is cryptography being attacked? I didn't speak about weak implementations because Matt Green announced Heartbleed in his talk. I thought he will speak about this, but he didn't. But I guess that's another problem. But you heard probably about it yesterday. You can ask for the keys or replace public keys. You can undermine the standards like was done in Dual EC. Or maybe you make brave stuff. And we don't know too much about this. We don't know what the state of the art is. Of course, we can guess that some government agencies today can break 1024-bit keys. They can exhaustively search 80-bit keys. But we don't know too much about capabilities there. But some other things that help is complex standards. If you look at IPsec, I mean, if you tell an engineer to study this standard, it's going to take a while. And can you ever understand it fully, and can you ever implement it securely? I think complexity also doesn't help. We discussed export controls. These were things that existed in the 90s, but apparently still come back and haunt us today. And by the way, of course, there are still export controls even today, and which I find really funny. For example, European regulations, they still limit you to certain nations to 512-bit keys and 56-bit keys, which was like some decision from 1995, is now hard-coded in 2015 European regulation. So probably in 2025, will still bite back at us. So then hardware backdoors, I spoke about those, software backdoors, the 0 days. And then, of course, there is also the law enforcement who claims that they are going dark, and of course they want to have backdoors. This was discussed also in the previous talk at length. Again, this will probably harm us in the long run if we have backdoors. I guess technical people understand that fully. So now we're going to look at deployment of crypto and see how we've been doing. And in some sense, I think I've been very privileged because as an academic researcher, I started working on crypto about 30 years ago. And when I did, in fact, from day one, I was actually consulting for financial companies and working a little bit with the Belgian government because they had no crypto expertise outside the university. But crypto was very rare then. A crypto box costed $10,000, at least. And there was some crypto in the banks, and most of it was in the government, and that was it. There were some attempts to roll out secure phones, but again, only for government use. So if we now look at crypto today, it's actually massively deployed. So you can, in some sense, say that my generation has been extremely successful. And I don't take much credit for this. I'm just a researcher, but I think the industry has been extremely successful to getting crypto adopted. Okay? So positive things, because it's always good to have some good news, that, for example, Google and Microsoft, a few months after Snowden revelations, decided to upgrade their TLS connections to Diffie-Hellman. They had the code there for a long time, but it was a bit slower than RSA, but they decided to pay the price and go for it. You see also that you heard about TLS 1.3 yesterday. There is major improvements in security there. And for example, Firefox, quite a few months ago only, it actually surpassed that more than 50% of HTTPS traffic. So more than 50% of the traffic with Firefox browser is encrypted. So this is fantastic. Now this is not only the geeks, the paranoids, it's almost for everybody now. This is fantastic good news. But then if you look at crypto devices, I tried to do a check, and maybe some of you have more numbers. I'm always interested in updating those. I did those somewhere on a lazy afternoon. I tried to find out how many crypto devices we have in the world. And I found that there is about, it's something more than 30 billion, but 18 billion are actually there to protect the industry. What do I mean by this? That it's not to protect user data. It's not to protect communication of you with your friends or your spouse or your kids. Most of the crypto is there to protect industry. So the largest one, of course, is bank cards. And you can argue that bank cards protect your money, which is correct. But of course, the main task of a bank card is make sure that your bank is protected against you. You don't spend too much money. Okay? Access cards, you can argue it protects your company. I mean, it actually prevents people from getting access to companies. Secure update mechanism is also very large. It's 3 billion. And it's great that you know that an update is secure, which means it comes from the vendor. On the other hand, you have no control over the update. Maybe the update has 10 features and you like 7 and you hate 3, but you don't have a choice. Actually, the update enforces what industry wants to be on your device, right? So then there is, I color those things yellow because, you know, it's kind of good for me, also good for industry. It's in the middle. Of course, the DRM, this is good for the media industry, and of course, I also understand this is important that DRM is there, especially for the movie industry, because without the money they would make, they couldn't make the movies. So I'm not against DRM, but I don't think we can argue that DRM has helped the security of users, right? And I think very often to the contrary, because of DRM, we've put stuff in our devices which actually makes security worse. And I mean, so just think of the Sony case where they put actually a rootkit into their music CD to prevent you from hacking it. I mean, this is a very good example. So we also have crypto now in passports and ID cards, not in the US, but in Europe, this is kind of for hundreds of millions. So a big success for industry, but not so maybe for users. So users actually have about 14 billion devices that protect them, and the biggest one, of course, is mobile phone. This is about 6 billion. So most of you, since you have second generation phone, so 2G, 3G, 4G, there is encryption in your phone. There is just one small comment, it's not end-to-end. The encryption doesn't go from your phone to the other phone. It's actually decrypted in the fixed network so that law enforcement can have access. And of course, what we've discovered recently is that this fixed network, SS7, is completely insecure. If you bribe some operator in a poor country, you get access to the SS7 network and you can actually control any phone or listen to any phone in the world. So I'm not sure we did a very good job there protecting our users. Then we have 3.5 billion. This is the TLS SSL system. I think it's a fantastic ecosystem. I think I still colored it red because of the governance problem. I think maybe with TLS 1.3 it gets better, but we still have the problem of the certificates in the browser, certificates in the mobile phones. We don't have a good governance for this. As long as we don't have transparency, as long as we don't have better check of the code, I still think we don't do a good service. In a sense, yes, we do protect many users against eavesdropping when they're, say, in the cyber cafe or eavesdropping by their ISPs, but if you're a really dedicated opponent, you can actually circumvent or bypass TLS to the certificate mechanism. And as long as we don't fix this in a very good way, I'm afraid I'll put this still color red. So then we go over to the right, we have their hard disk encryption, $500 million. If you go buy a hard disk today, it has encryption. But do you know what happens if you unplug the hard disk and you plug it in another machine? Shall I tell you what happens? It works. So this is, of course, not for the business hard disks. In business environments, there is key management, and if you unplug a hard disk and plug it in a new one, it will not work. But the consumer PC, there is no key management. And the users don't want to have a BIOS password. They deactivate this, and most people have encrypted hard disks, but they have no security whatsoever, in the sense that if they cross a border with this, in fact, the data is just readable. So there is encryption, but no security. Then we go to secure messaging. So we have Skype, which is not open. And then we have WhatsApp and iMessage. This is actually $500 million to $1 billion. So I think we're doing quite okay, although Skype is not open. And you may know that the Snowden documents make it very clear that the NSA has acquired the ability to intercept Skype-to-Skype calls. And Skype-to-Skype was, in its design, peer-to-peer and was European. But apparently some of those things have changed in the structure since it was acquired by a large U.S. corporation. So as a consequence of Snowden, I think Apple and WhatsApp are doing a great job in rolling out protocols based on single, so actually having secure messaging. But of course, the metadata is still in public. Plus, it turns out that for convenience, in case you drop your device in the toilet, in fact, you can just get a new phone, log in, and all your data is there again. So from this, you can deduce that there is actually a backup in clear in the cloud. Okay, so you actually have secure messaging with a backup in clear in the cloud. Now, if you remember the third slide, which had about Prism, then you should think about this. So you're protected against some agents, but not against others. And I guess the only thing I put in green here is that your phones now encrypt apparently in a quite decent way. And it seems that Apple does a bit more effort than Android. Also that in Android, I guess there is now 2 billion Android devices, but I think it's only the most recent versions that do a good job at this. So there, I'm kind of optimistic, but let's see how good this really is. I guess more research is needed, but that at least it shows we can encrypt user data properly. But I think overall, I think as an industry, if you go see your family members and say what you do and how do you protect data of users, I'm not sure we can be so proud of what we achieved. And I think we can do better and we should do better with this. So in communication security, of course, even secure channels is still a challenge. We actually are discovering, have been discovering in the last 5 years, many new issues related to how you secure a channel. We thought we understood this, but by doing TLS in the 90s and IPsec, I think in the last 5 years, we actually learned a lot that this is much more complex than we thought it was. Think of fragmentation, think of secure negotiation of algorithms, and so on and so on. And so there is also the CSER competition, which will end eventually, somewhere this year or maybe somewhere next year. You can ask Dan Bernstein more about this, where we look at new schemes for authenticated encryption. There is more forward secrecy. We have to look at denial of service. It's still a fact that the basic internet protocols are not very secure. We're still working on secure routing. Most people seem to know this, but kind of suppress this information. So if you announce a fast route to any internet node today, you know what happens? All traffic comes to you. How do we know? Because there is a large nation in Asia that tried it and it works. Okay? In fact, you actually will be completely flubbered, but this is what you can do today. There is, of course, research on secure routing, but there is still zero deployment. Okay, I will not enter the discussion of DNS. There is a standard there, but the deployment is also not very good. And so some people even think we should start from scratch and rethink networking from scratch. The elephant in the room, of course, is metadata, because most governments, and I think also to some extent your government, believes that you have some rights, that your data is protected, but whether your metadata is protected, this is completely unclear. And we heard in the previous talk that in the US, for example, location data seems to be seen as not data. And I guess what researchers keep saying is metadata is data. And it's actually quite sensitive to know who you call, where you are, which websites you visit. There aren't much solutions. There is Tor. And Tor has a couple of millions of users, but Tor is actually not designed to resist global adversaries, powerful adversaries. So it has many shortcomings. It's the best we have today. But Tor only hides your IP address. It doesn't hide your location. For location privacy, there is probably a couple of 100 papers, and deployment is zero. You can actually run a mobile phone network where the operator doesn't know where the users are. There is papers describing you how to do this. But of course, nobody has tried this for obvious reasons. So then about computer security, what about the end systems? Okay, so of course, if data at rest is kind of the easy thing to protect, you could just encrypt your hard disk, encrypt your mobile phone, and maybe also encrypt your data in the cloud. But of course, then we end up in the key management problem. And most of us store, as users, our stuff in the cloud, but then, of course, having it encrypted makes the key management more complex. It means you have to get the same key on all your devices, and it becomes really awkward. Also, in companies, the same reasoning is very often allowed. I would really like to do a study like how much data in the cloud is really encrypted. And I don't mean TLS encrypted between the server and the cloud, but in the cloud itself. And I'm afraid it would be a very small number. Okay, so I think if you think about all these attacks, it's very important to understand that our infrastructure today is, in my view, way too centralized. And the architecture we have today is actually a political decision. And it may not be a deliberate political decision, but it may be a decision also being driven by business interests, like the advertising ecosystem that makes everything free to use as long as we pay with our data. But of course, if we're going to have our cars drive by themselves, if we're going to have our homes be online all the time, and if we're going to build our complete society based on this, maybe it's not so wise to have such a centralized architecture where one guy can put up saying, hey, I have a short route to everything, and then have 200 billion IoT nodes sending all their communication to this one site, and then everything getting jammed. So, in fact, I was at a conference of the hardware industry earlier this week, and what I heard there was very optimistic. I was very optimistic after coming back from this conference, because what I learned there is that the next revolution, the IoT revolution, will be mostly machine-to-machine communication, will be self-driving cars, will be industrial automation. And in fact, for humans, we can tolerate 100 millisecond delay because our brain is so slow. But for machines, we want 1 millisecond delays. And guess what? That means that you can't go to the cloud and come back in 1 millisecond. This is just not possible. So more or less, our networks will have to be more distributed and autonomous and make decisions locally. Okay, for delay reasons, also for energy reasons. Actually, sending all the data to a cloud, which is a solution today, and then we'll see later what we do with it, and we hope it doesn't get compromised. But it will not be possible because it consumes too much energy. And so I think as security people, we should take advantage of this and say, look, not only is it faster, lower latency, not only is it less energy, but also we're going to make it more secure and robust. So that just not one compromise or one security letter or one attack or one zero day can actually compromise everything. So we should, of course, have minimal disclosure. Okay, so maybe not collect too much, but because we find out that everything we collect gets eventually compromised. And try to encrypt stuff. And I guess use some crypto magic. But I guess the next talk you'll hear more about this. There is lots of fancy technologies that can help us. Conceived in the 80s and 90s, but that have not been deployed so far. Like, for example, threshold cryptography or proactive cryptography, where you actually spread data over multiple sites and you never have vulnerability to compromise or one or a few sites. Also, multi-party computation, again, something which was science fiction in the 70s, which kind of principally realized in the 80s, and today actually getting practical. Not for everything, but it's possible to do this, to make much more robust systems. Distributed systems work, like the root keys of Visa are distributed. Skype was distributed for a long time, and it worked. And also Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are distributed. So we can actually build global systems which are distributed and robust. So I think if it's not for reasons of energy or latency, it should be for security, that we should not put our data in the cloud, but actually keep it local and encrypted. To me personally, I'm always amazed that the industry tells me that this is a mobile phone of 64 gigabytes, but if they have to tell me which advertisements I want to see, they need to have the data, my data in the cloud. Why is this device with 8 processors and 64 gigabytes not capable of saying which advertisements Bart wants to see? Why? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know the answer. It can perfectly figure it out. It has all my information. It can tell exactly this to the cloud. But somehow the model is we have to put everything in the cloud and then there you figure out which advertisement you want to see. Okay, this is, it keeps baffling me. I'm just an academic. I must not understand things, but it's really amazing. So we can still compute stuff like advertising, proximity testing, set intersection, so interests, road pricing, insurance pricing, all those things can be done with localized secure computation in those devices, and these devices are now powerful enough. It would be a very good way of using them. Okay? Of course, if you go for this architecture, some people who use fraud detection by checking everything, this approach will be much more difficult because you will not have mass surveillance, you will not have massive collection on everything, so you will have to find new ways to detect fraud or abuse. And there is cases where you have to put data together. This is clear. A very good example is genomic analysis. If you want to do modern medicine, you want to operate on DNA, but if you want to search, say, among 100,000 people, how many have certain genes in common, you have to put it in the same place, but then you can do it in encrypted form. And I will not overpromise, we should not overpromise here, but it's actually possible for some things to do that. Okay, so I'll wrap up. Just 2 more slides. If you think about the backdoor discussion, of course, the dual EC backdoor was a backdoor in a standard. But of course, if you read the cryptobiology book or the kleptography papers very carefully, you'll find out that there is a clear conclusion that you cannot trust somebody else's module, or if somebody deliberately puts backdoors in there, it's very hard to find out, right? Not only in the crypto, but also in code. So I think if we really want to put our society, build our society, have our cars, our energy systems, our homes, our offices, all depend on IT in a critical way, also our robots and everything, it should all be open. I think that's the only way we'll be able to assure security and build a society where people can actually can trust the infrastructure. And if you think about it, in society what you want is the powerful are transparent and the individuals have some privacy. But in the current technology, it's just the other way around. The powerful are opaque, they can't tell you their algorithms, commercial secrets, the government can't tell you what we do because that would actually help the bad guys. But all of us, we're completely transparent. And I think we should actually change this power balance and we should try to do this. So time to wrap up. We have lots of things to do. We have to rethink architectures. We have to, of course, work on secure building blocks. As Matt Green also argued, we're not done at all there. We need more open technologies to build our society on. That's the only way we can build a trustworthy society. And I guess there is cool advanced crypto. I mean, like the things conceived in the 80s, it should be rolled out in the 2010 or 2020s. It's possible to do much cooler stuff than what we have today. And I want to conclude by, I don't always agree with Microsoft, but this time I do. So at last RSA conference, Brad Smith, the Microsoft president, actually said, that the Geneva Convention says that we should not attack civilians in times of war. What we are doing in our ICT systems today is attacking civilians in time of peace. And this is what our nation states seem to be doing, and we should stop this. So he called for a digital Geneva Convention. And I don't agree with all the fine details of his proposal, but I think it's something we should start a conversation about, and I really want you to think about this. Thank you very much for your attention.
We're moving into the next session now. If you have a brief question, feel free to ask on the side or maybe walk outside and speak to our guest.
There we go. Oh, thank you. Perfect. I appreciate that. Whatever you need to do, you do it. No problem. I think I'm up and ready. Oh, let me do present. Hang on 1 second. Slideshow. From the beginning. Ta-da. Ready, ta-da. Let's hope, ta-da. Ta-da. Okay.
Make sure that when you're standing here, you have a deep voice, but make sure you're talking into the microphone too.